are the Afghanistan evacuees arriving in New England to begin their new lives, their adjustment will take weeks, months, perhaps years. On Tuesday's program, we discuss the housing crisis that await for those looking to put down roots and the struggle to get paperwork so they can obtain financial independence. But it's not just the Afghan people who have to reconstruct their lives. Haitians, Puerto Ricans, and Vietnamese have had to resettle in our region to begin a new life. While all groups are hoping for better resources, we discussed today that the process is far from easy for most and extremely difficult for others. Welcome to And Another Thing. I'm Dara Kennedy.
And I'm Maya Schwader. In addition to telling the stories of these people, today we turn our focus to what Afghans can expect once they get here. Many will have to learn a new language, adapt to a new culture, and find a new community, a home away from home. Mustafa Al-Naimi knows something about this. Originally from Iraq, he came to the U.S. in 2010, and he is now a caseworker for the Refugee and Immigrant Assistance Center of Boston, Lynn, and Worcester. He is, in fact, assisting one Afghan family and three individuals now living in Worcester, and he joins us now to tell us more about the experience ahead for them. Mustafa, thank you so much for joining us. When you're working with these new arrivals, are you able to use your experience of what it was like to move here to help them go through the similar motions they have to do to establish their new lives?
Yes. Good evening, everyone. So my name is Mustafa Naimi. Yes. So we usually, once the families or singles arrive, we start to work with them right away from the airport, and we use our experience because I've been doing that more than 11 years. Other settlement refugees and immigrants, some of them are SIB, some of them refugees. We try to help them to do all the work since they arrived till they be a U.S. citizenship.
Mustafa, what was the most challenging part of the process for you?
The most challenging, like, when they arrive, it's a new system for them, so they don't know the laws, the regulations, and about the life system, and everything is changed for them because the life or the place they came from is totally different than what we have here.
Let's talk about that a little bit. What are some of the biggest differences between here where we are in New England and what their old lives were like?
Sure. So everything from the climate, weather, different. The let's say when they arrive, the system of the driving is different. The challenge of the papers, you know, they have to get the social security. You have to apply for the benefits. You need to apply for the job. Everything online back there is different. It's about you get job from friends or people you know. So you need to know the resources and communication with the community engagement.
In terms of the cultural experience, what is set up for people when they get there so that they're not feeling so much like fish out of water in terms of food and religion and people that speak their language?
All right. Yeah, that's why. So once they arrive, try to connect them with the people from the community. So they help them to learn so quick about what they have to do, what they have to learn. And because when they come here, like I went try in 2010, there's only few people here for them, so it's hard to know. So, but by time, people, they start knowing what they have to do. Then we try to gather them as the families and friends and do culture broker for them. So that makes them help and easy to learn more about the education here.
The families and the people who you're working with right now, how are they doing?
They are doing okay, but it takes them like 1 to 2 years to get used about everything here.
And what's the most, are you overwhelmed at this moment because there are so many people that are starting to come into the region?
Yes, usually we get one family or two family per month, but we're hearing there's a lot are coming from Afghanistan. They are going to come to Massachusetts. And so that's why there's a lot of agencies are cooperating with us to resettlement those families. And it's definitely going to be a hard task, and you have to prepare well from everything, from winter clothes, from school backpack, because some families have kids. Then, like, house items, furniture, finding apartments, going to be a lot of work to do.
When you moved here from Iraq, what was one of the biggest challenges for you?
Oh, I can say the language and the system.
Is healthcare also an issue?
Healthcare, I mean, this was, yes, because when I came here, I like you need to learn about there's something called family doctors, and you have to, when you have a problem, you need to communicate with the specialist. So, yes, so for me, it takes me some time to learn about healthcare as well. Yes. And some families, they have chronic diseases, and some of them, they have some, they take medications, and that medication is overseas, is different than here, and their bodies have to get used to what's here. So kind of going to be hard for them as well.
What does it mean to you to be able to help new arrivals through these processes, having gone through it yourself?
What can I help with provide them, or what can I didn't get your question.
What does it mean to you to be able to guide them through this process, to be able to use your experience?
Yes, my experience about, I mean, because once they arrive here with knowing what every problem they will face, so we try to navigate them to get the real resources, to meet the people who are going to help them to do their papers, like from the welcoming them at the airport to find them a place to live, to apply them for a job, till we create their resume, and, you know, show them, like, the transportation system, the medical system, the education system, is they have to learn all that. So they get their green card and citizenship and the rest of coming.
Mustafa Al-Naimi is a caseworker with the Refugee and Immigrant Assistance Center of Boston, Lynn, and Worcester. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
You're welcome, appreciate it. Have a good day.
The crisis in Afghanistan is not the only surge of migrants that the U.S. is seeing right now. According to the Boston Globe, more than 100 families from Haiti have arrived in Massachusetts in recent weeks from the Mexican border. And while we've seen many groups open arms for the Afghans, the Haitians have had a harder time being welcomed and received.
Joining us now to discuss more of what Haitians face in the region is Dr. Gerald Gabeau. She is the executive director of the Immigrant Family Services Institute, a nonprofit organization that works with the Haitian community across New England. Dr. Gabeau, thank you so much for joining us. This is an extremely busy time for your organization. Can you tell us why?
Yes, thank you so much for having us. It's such a pleasure to be with you. Yes, it is a very busy time because, in a way, we are left on our own to figure out ways to support our brothers and sisters who are here from Del Rio, Texas, or from some of the detention centers where they were set after the images that we all saw on TV a couple of weeks ago. And I'm glad that you mentioned the Afghan situation where a lot of, organizations, the federal government, you know, even the Biden administration, everyone is taking steps to welcome them, which is the right thing to do in providing resources to welcome them. However, when it comes to Haitians, there is absolutely nothing available to them. So we as community leaders, we have to find ways to support them, which is a shame for the United States of America that we came to know.
Mrs. Gabeau, the arrival of tens of thousands of Haitian immigrants at the Mexican border has generated criticism all around, and the government has been accused of handling this very poorly. What have you heard is the latest from there at the border?
Yeah, so what we've heard is that the government continues the flight. Yes, definitely. So what's going on right now, the fact that, our migrants are not on the news under the bridge, everyone believes that everything is okay, when in fact, you know, the U.S. government is expediting, you know, the removal of Haitians every day by the thousands. So far, we have 72 flights to Haiti, with 10,000 Haitians, sent back to Haiti with no due process whatsoever, while some others are able to come here, but with absolutely no resources.
The Boston Globe is reporting that a lot of these people would otherwise be sleeping on the streets without help from agencies like yours. Tell us a little bit about how you have to work to get places for these people to sleep every night.
Yes, so we have to bring the entire community together to help, to guide, to support, and to provide resources to the families. So we have to be connected to everyone, the churches, you know, the different organizations, as a way to make sure that everyone can at least stay for one night here, two nights there. So currently we are trying to rent space for those families, because every day they come here to the office, and because they don't really have a place, they spend the entire day with us to wait until the night to go somewhere. So we are currently working with the City of Boston through the Mayor's Office of Immigrant Advancement to identify ways that we can support those people. But again, because there is no provision for them, they would have been in the street if we didn't step into the process.
Dr. Gabo, thank you so much for joining us. She is the Executive Director of the Immigrant Family Services Institute. When we return, we'll learn more of the groups that have needed to restart their lives, and we'll be joined by experts on the Vietnamese and Puerto Rican communities. This is And Another Thing.
You're listening to And Another Thing. I'm Dara Kennedy. Today, according to the Immigration Project, Global Boston, Vietnamese refugees and immigrants make up the second largest Asian immigrant group in our region. The U.S. has become one of several countries to resettle Southeast Asian refugees in the wake of communist takeover in 1975. Professor Marilyn Johnson is the executive director of their project, and she joins us now. Professor Johnson, welcome to And Another Thing. How is it
that... Thank you for having me.
Sure. Thank you for joining us. What is happening with the Afghans now? How is that similar to what the Vietnamese went through when they came to America in the 70s?
Well, it's startlingly similar, actually. You know, thinking back to the scenes of the helicopters leaving from the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon in 1975, and all the chaos accompanying the pullout of the U.S. from that conflict after many years. We seem to be living through it again with the Afghan situation recently.
Dr. Johnson, there is also a community on the other side of these flights that has to take in these new people. Do you see parallels in the way that the people who already live here are reacting to the new arrivals?
I haven't had much exposure to the most recent situation and people coming in, but I imagine that the systems established particularly in the 1980s after the passage of the 1980 Refugee Act, which created various laws and offices on the federal level and also on the state level to facilitate the resettlement of refugees. So I don't think we would have what we have today without that experience of the 1970s and 80s.
Are you seeing any challenges that are happening now that challenges from when the Vietnamese came over, right? And they've settled down into First Corner there in Boston. Anything that you can offer to the Afghans and other refugees and immigrants that are coming over to help the process run smoother?
Well, one thing I think is clear is that this is not sort of a one-shot deal. If you look at the experience of Vietnamese refugees, it was a struggle that went on for more than 20 years, really until the normalization of U.S.-Vietnamese relations in 1995. There's actually an excellent new book out on this subject by a historian named Amanda Demmer. It's called After Saigon's Fall, and she talks about the role of Vietnamese groups, refugee groups themselves, who lobbied for many years the U.S. government to allow more refugees to come because it happened over such a prolonged period. Not everyone left in 1975. You had military and political leaders in South Vietnam and those who were allied with the U.S. government who were able to leave in 1975, but then several other waves of refugees, the so-called boat people, ethnic Chinese, and people from rural areas and other variety of different reasons for leaving, who were fleeing in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And you had others who were fleeing by land to the refugee camps on the Thai-Cambodian border.
Right.
And it took years to get people from those refugee camps back into the U.S. And,
Professor, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us. That was Professor Marilyn Johnson, the Executive Director of Global Boston.
Not that long ago, another group was forced to flee when hurricanes ravaged the American territory of Puerto Rico. Citizens of our country since 1917, they too have been faced with challenges of settlement within our communities, many foreign to them. According to a report in the Daily Hampshire Gazette, more than 2,000 displaced families became residents of the city of Holyoke after the Hurricane Maria wreaked havoc on the island in 2017.
According to the 2010 census, Holyoke was already home to the largest Puerto Rican community outside of Puerto Rico even before the hurricane pushed many on the island to leave. To discuss their experience of resettling in the Pioneer Valley, we are joined now by Chloe Soto, the Community Engagement Coordinator of the Community Development Corporation Nueva Esperanza in Holyoke. Chloe, thank you so much for joining us. When someone leaves home, moving to a new place is incredibly difficult. How does having a community already there make things easier?
Well, first off, thank you so much for having me today. I'm so happy to be here. For Holyoke itself, I think it was just strategically already positioned with you know, the Latinx community there already to sort of embrace the people that were coming in from Puerto Rico right after the hurricane. I mean, nearly immediately 8% of the population in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria migrated here to the States, and a lot of them relocated to Holyoke.
Even before Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, were there issues, economic and political forces, that were forcing residents to leave the island and come over to the mainland?
I mean, if we start with the Jones Act, there's always been this problem with Puerto Rico economically. We can get educated there, but usually we don't have the jobs there to maintain the populace, right? So we have people having to leave the islands for better economic opportunities here in the States. It's been problematic for a long time now. And I think the fact that the Jones Act really does hurt Puerto Rico in a way, and in a very large way. And, you know, it's just really hard to survive on the island when there are no jobs to be found, when people have to, you know, relocate stateside in order to be able to survive and live and pay off student loans or debt or whatever it may be.
But the Jones Act was described to help the Puerto Ricans so that there would be jobs and so that they could become citizens in America and so that they would be able to move freely between the island and the mainland, yeah?
It's true. And, you know, it's a fact that if the Jones Act wasn't there, large ships would be able to drop off their cargo in San Juan that would be from foreign countries, and it wouldn't have to be American ships. So there's all these fees that are involved, and those trickle down to the consumer, right? Because we pay a higher rate for goods coming into the country. If, you know, it's extremely frustrating at this time. And, you know, so if whoever doesn't know, you know, the law does date back to 1920, and it requires that all goods that are ferried between the U.S. ports to be carried by ships built and owned and operated by Americans. So it just makes the ships far more expensive to buy and operate. American ships, I'm sorry, are far more expensive to buy and operate than ships flying foreign flags. And as a result, it just makes everything in Puerto Rico much more expensive.
So not only are there issues of expensive goods, but NBC News is reporting that we are 4 years out from Hurricane Maria. There are still many damaged homes on the island, constant power outages. Reconstruction has been slow. Are there still folks who are choosing to leave Puerto Rico to move to places like Holyoke?
Absolutely. It's an ongoing thing. So we call it the Puerto Rican diaspora. And it's, you know, people are just trying to find a better way to live, you know, a way to survive, to make a living wage. And, you know, and that unfortunately only happens here stateside. Right now, Puerto Rico is in a situation where there are so many millennials leaving right now. So people are graduating from university and looking for jobs here, which hurts Puerto Rico's economy.
So then what's the upside to moving then to the mainland?
I mean, obviously, it's going to be better economic opportunities, better job market, you know, the opportunity to sort of own a piece of Americana, right? We are looking for that American dream. We want to own our own piece of property. It really is about attaining some sort of stability, right? We want to make sure that for generations to come, we're able to provide them with the opportunity to have, you know, an education, a home, generational wealth, things of that nature.
Puerto Ricans are American citizens. They are allowed to come to the mainland at their will. But if someone moves here, is there still a certain amount of culture shock to grapple with?
I believe it really depends on where you land, right? So I think that Puerto Rico is Holyoke is very welcoming. And because right now we are at 53.9% of the population of the city, which is, you know, it's shocking, right? But we were able to embrace, and we have all these great organizations in Puerto Rico. You know what? I'm sorry about that. It's just like really Holyoke does feel like a little Puerto Rico, right? Because our population is so large.
It makes sense.
Right? So, you know, again, I think it's been easy for certain people because we're able to embrace them. We have these great, great organizations. And we all work together to make sure that, you know, everybody's provided for, that people are fed, that, you know, Betty Lichtenstein Medina from Enlace de Familias was amazing during that entire period.